Merci. Je suis très flatté d'être parmi vous. Michel Foucault, ses philosophies ont influencé non seulement le monde de l'anthropologie, mais aussi elle a changé la méthode de notre proposition. And it is this change in the method and the stakes of proposing questions that lies at the heart of my presentation today. Namely, how ethnography itself contends with the presence of subjects and how anthropology remains unabsolved of the aftermath when these subjects disappear. And I think my engagement with Michel Foucault is of a different order than many of the talks that have come before. I'm thinking here of the very first presentation in the conference by Mathieu Bonneville, when he was listing places in which Foucault's thought has come to rest, anthropology, sociology, etc. And at the very end of that list, he mentioned something, recherche vulgaire, and I think maybe this this talk falls into this category of recherche vulgaire, much in the way that sort of Kang Yem thinks about the concept of health itself as a concept vulgaire, and the sort of crude concept or a productive concept that requires some kind of individual specificity to actually have meaning and to have a resonance. And just a little bit of background about the talk that I'm presenting. It's based on a large ethnographic project that was aimed at better understanding how adolescents who are addicted to drugs, whether it's heroin or prescription painkillers, different opiates, were receiving treatment with a new pharmacotherapy, a drug called buprenorphine, which is under the trade name in France as Subutex, which is a drug to treat heroin addiction. And I followed these adolescents for 3 years inside and outside the clinic to better understand how success and failure of a pharmacotherapy resonates or holds meaning in the lives of these adolescents. So this is something of a little bit of a background for the talk today. And of course, I begin with an apology that my presentation is in English. So I hope whatever's lost in the presentation can be regained when the translated version of my paper appears, which I trust will continue whatever conversation begins today. The disappearance of subjects in an ethnography of addiction does not offer closure or finality to the ethnographic encounter, but instead raises difficult questions regarding the stakes and values inherent in anthropological work, perhaps especially work that takes as its object disorder and suffering. During my study of adolescence, treated for opiate addiction with a new drug, buprenorphine, inside and outside the clinic, two of the adolescents that I followed died, and another was lost to me in the tangle of clinical and criminal legal system institutions in Baltimore, Maryland, in the United States. Rather than taking death and loss as tropes to frame and organize meaning in the lives of these adolescents, I suggest that addiction and treatment and their aftermath force a broader definition of self-care as a technology of living, one that recognizes the conditions of a life must incorporate the lived realities of local moral worlds and, at times, severely constrained agency at the level of the individual. There's a strange sense of surprise that arises when drugs take up residence in the lives of adolescents, as if substance abuse can remain wholly separate as a category of experience, unlike violence or other forms of abuse, social exclusion, material deprivation, etc. The reality is drugs often reside at the center of life. The aim of an ethnography of addiction is not then to simply restore drugs to a singular position, to recuperate drugs and the subjects of an ethnography about drugs to a field of visibility, but instead it is to show that the work that drugs and therapeutics do, as well as to assess the claims of such work. In this paper, I hope to direct fresh light towards the forms of evidence that go into such claims. Evidence quite literally as what is seen, what is spoken to, what is attested to, and what is lived. I'm thinking here of the commitment to a philosophical anthropology that Michel Foucault describes in a well-known quotation. The role of philosophy, quote, "The role of philosophy is not to discover what is hidden, but to render visible that which is precisely visible, to reveal that which is close, which is so immediate, which is so closely related to ourselves that we do not perceive it. Whereas the role of science is to make known what we do not see, the role of philosophy is to show what we do see. In the following pages, I aim to make what is seen and what is attested to in therapeutics ethnographically conspicuous by drawing attention to the details of individuals' lives. Disappearances. I want to address the problems and realities of disappearance in an ethnography of addiction. In the clinic and other institutional environments through which I would follow them, adolescents would come in and out of my view often. It was not uncommon for there to be 1 or 2 months between the times I would reconnect with young men and women as I was attempting to follow them in my study. For my part, the times in between were admittedly anxious. There was no guarantee that I would see or talk to them again. Every interaction, whether a conversation in a living room or a shared meal in a treatment center cafeteria, felt like it might be the last. Disappearance is a problem in an ethnography of adolescents abusing drugs, not because it shatters the illusion of continuity in the ethnographic encounter, but because it foregrounds a set of concerns regarding the values and assumptions shared between anthropological and clinical work, unmaking what would otherwise be a straightforward narration of addiction and recovery. Disappearance is a reality because it reflects the conditions and circumstances of individuals' lives that cannot be pushed off the page of anthropological writing. The headings technology of the self or the care of the self have given anthropology for a long time now the space to move out from other previous frameworks of selfhood or personhood. Anthropologists have challenged the ideas of selfhood by showing the moral and historical exteriority is folded inward at the level of the individual, replaced by notions of subjectivity riddled by structural forces, cultural sensibilities, subjective viscositudes, political tensions, pragmatic forces, and rhetorical pitches. And here I'm interested in the individual experience of therapy articulated in the terms Michel Foucault offers as the formation of subjectivity by the individual as the conditions of a self-care. However, the individual, the self, the person, the subject, as an object of study needs to be clear. There is a distinction between the individual as a general category and the individuated subject as a singular category, best articulated in the works of Deleuze and Samandon, etc. To talk about the experience of therapeutics as self-care is to speak about the individuated subject. However, just as the medical subject comes under different headings, life too comes under different headings as well. What does it mean to be human, or more specifically, to make claims of the living? To talk about the value and worth of life is to talk about the value of a life. Following the introduction of Georges Canguilhem's minor thesis, Knowledge of Life, La Connaissance de la Vie, thought, le pensier, and the living, la vivant, are not separate or contradictory, but come to rest upon one another. Nothing of life absents itself or is unmade by thought. Yet, as both François Dagonet, Georges Canguilhem have shown, and Georges Canguilhem have shown, there's an implicit split between thought and living, knowledge and life, in research science, in therapeutics, and in clinical medicine. Life is an object examined from the outside. But if we turn our attention to the speaking subject, even when that subject is formed through techniques of confession and concealment, as is Foucault's argument, we find an alternative way of being that is taken up by adolescents under pharmacotherapy. Life and thought would include transformations over time, and the experience of therapy would do more than simply run alongside the idea of therapeutics. Knowledge derived from studying treatment is not distinct from its lived experience, something which does not necessarily require the language of embodiment to hold meaning. In this way, the separation between philosophies of experience and of the subject, and philosophies of concepts, knowledge, rationality, may be less distinct than what Foucault suggests in his famous essay on the works of Georges Canguilhem, La Vie, l'Expérience et la Science. So-called authentic experience, living, is not measured against rationality, the thought of living, in the therapeutic experience of pharmacotherapy or drug treatment. The transformation of thought about life does not unmake the experience of living. Instead, it challenges the assumption of experience itself, and in this case, the experience upon which addiction and therapeutics are predicated. If therapeutic success can only be assessed on the individual register, then the value of life becomes synonymous with the values attributed to individual health. Now, I'm not suggesting that self-care, or more specifically, the way adolescents manage themselves in the therapeutic process, forms some kind of model of addiction experience. The creation of value, of recovery, of dwelling with drug dependency, of making it, of not making it, is an individual value that has the capacity to run counter to the way therapeutic interventions are imagined. Nevertheless, the clinical value of being and remaining under treatment becomes quickly conflated with the personal values attached to a therapy by adolescents under that treatment, as well as their families, the kinds of demands that are made. In some ways, this is an easy observation to make. The difficulty is to avoid clumsy misattributions of agency in the narrative of dependency and treatment. Perhaps it is especially difficult when the illness narrative becomes the source of all knowing. Through the convention of anthropological writing, the speaking subject tells a story, one that calls attention to uncomfortable details and raises puzzling questions about truth, believability, the meaning of what is said, all the while knowing that confession and concealment are not processes of inner subjectivity, but rather are the foundations for a concept of self. The desire for continuity in ethnographic telling is not so much about meaning as it is about making sense of things. Along these lines, I've attempted to offer a straightforward approach in as much as possible to the ethnographic writing that follows. These small reflections come from my notes and are written simply and directly, even those parts which seem to refuse analytical precision. Into the fold of family. Two of the adolescents that I followed died. Their deaths occurred months after the last time I spoke with either one of them at the clinic and the variety of environments that they called home. The deaths forced me to rethink many things about my work, not least of which was how to write about their deaths in a way that would not evacuate the content of their stories, or more dangerously, orient their stories towards the inevitability of dying. Tanya was a tiny white girl from Baltimore County, whose parents' home was not far from the residential treatment center in which I did my work. The first thing I noticed about her was how feminine she looked compared to the other girls at the treatment center. She was precocious and completely self-assured. She was petite but comported herself almost like an adult. Tanya spoke with a slightly southern accent, having spent many summers with extended family in West Virginia and Delaware. In the months leading up to the drug possession charge and admission into the treatment center, she began snorting and smoking heroin with her boyfriend. Tanya loathed residential treatment and hated the confinement and routine of institutional life. She wanted to make a home for herself outside the restrictive atmosphere of the treatment center. Tanya expressed a desire for independence, yet she would describe at great length her dependence upon and complicated relationship with her boyfriend. "He's good to me, you know. He doesn't put hands on me or nothing. We get fighting sometimes, but you know, who don't?" She talked about sex with her boyfriend, and the candor with which she spoke about her sexual history was unnerving. I came to realize these details were not entirely meant to shock or provoke, but were offered as evidence of her boyfriend's love and caring for her. There was something desperate in the way she gave evidence to the care in her relationship. Her eagerness was complicated by the fact that she gave every indication that there was something amiss in the relationship. She would leave some statements about her boyfriend intentionally vague. "He ain't a pimp. He'd never force me to do anything I don't want to. I mean, I get to make my own choices about things." Maybe he'd say, like, "Do this, do that, but still it's my choice." Statements such as these were often void of context or detail. Tanya broke up with her boyfriend 2 months after she was discharged from the residential treatment center. Almost immediately after she was discharged, they'd begun using together again. And at some point, he became violent and insisted that she trade sex for drugs or money to support their mutual habit. She refused, and he beat her very badly. He burned her clothes in a bathtub before he left the apartment and smashed the windows of her car that she had borrowed from a friend. Tanya told me the details of the incident weeks later after it had happened. She held a cigarette cupped in her hand and recounted the details through a thin trail of smoke rising between her fingers. "We were sitting on a bench outside a convenience store in a light rain, around the corner from the new place that she was staying. Quote, "That bitch landlord kicked me out. The fire department had to come and put out the fire, and the next day I had to go and find all my stuff. I got found with drug paraphernalia," she told me. "And I know it was like the fire department coming that done it. I know she thinks I'm a whore too. Fuck her. I hope her daughter gets what happened to me. Who puts out a girl with a beat-up face? In a strange twist, it was the boyfriend's aunt who took in Tanya. I had no clothes, and he stole my purse on his way out with all my money and ID and stuff in it. He left me for dead, she's telling me this while she's laughing. She, the ex-boyfriend's aunt, always liked me, almost like a daughter, I guess. Several weeks passed before the next time we spoke. We agreed to meet again at the convenience store around the corner from her aunt's house for takeout food. Tanya was already there sitting on a bench, and I didn't recognize her at first. She was much thinner, which is hard to imagine given how small she was to begin with. She was wearing an oversized sweatshirt and her face was shrunken in. Her fingers were brownish and yellow from nicotine. When I returned from ordering food, I was blunt. Are you shooting up? Meaning injecting heroin. Tanya gave a shrug of indifference and was equally blunt with her answer. Yeah. Tanya was taken in by a group of older women at the aunt's house. She began injecting heroin almost immediately from the time she moved in with them. It was like a gift, you know, a welcome gift, like this is where you belong. I asked her how she was making money to support herself, but she wouldn't say, and I did not press the issue. She said that she was no longer allowed in the convenience store after being caught shoplifting, which explained in part her nervousness while talking to me on the bench out in front of the store. She would look up and down the street as we spoke, as though she was waiting or trying to avoid someone. I had no way of contacting her after her cell phone was cut off. I went by the house a few times, but there was never an answer on the door. A few months after we spoke, I found a contact number for her stepfather, who lived in Delaware, in her chart at the clinic. When I spoke with him, he told me that Tanya had died from complications related to an overdose a month earlier and abruptly hung up the phone. Recovery and loss. Jeff stopped using drugs altogether. After a few weeks at the treatment center and 1 month of outpatient therapy, he stopped treatment altogether too. I'm clean, I don't take drugs, not even weed. I'm back, he told me as we drove to his house from the corner in which he instructed me to drop him off. It's like I'm a different person, you know. You gotta be. There's no room for mistakes. I got money, I earned my place, it ain't easy. Jeff was shot and killed a little more than 3 months from the time he left the residential treatment center. And it's unclear if a drug sale went badly or if he was fighting with another dealer. According to his cousin, who had been the person that helped me stay in touch with Jeff after he left the treatment center, Jeff was shot twice on the side of the head. He didn't see it coming. 1 minute you're there and then nothing. He don't see himself go. I'm sure of it, Jeff's cousin told me. The funeral had happened a week before I called Jeff's cousin, hoping to talk to Jeff again, despite the fact that in our last conversation, it was clear that he did not want to see me again. I drove to Jeff's cousin's house, and then he drove me to the graveyard. There were pink silk flowers on top of the modest granite tombstone, a tombstone that had space for 3 more names and dates. The tombstone had his family name and his first name carved below, and his date of birth, 1991. It struck me how young he was when he died. Jeff's cousin asked if I could make a donation to help the funeral cost, which were still outstanding. Of course, I said. It was all I could think to say. The last conversation I had with Jeff was brief. He had reestablished himself on the street. He was clean. He had hardened. He didn't want to continue talking to me, though I told myself it was simply that he didn't want to be around someone who reminded himself, in his words, of his past life as an addict. When you clean, that's it, nothing else, fuck it. Jeff asserted himself in a way that demanded the disconnection from addiction and treatment. In whatever way, Jeff was successful in his efforts to wean himself off opiates. Tanya fell into a pattern of drug use that eventually ended her life. In both cases, there are details not easily reconciled. Tanya found a group of women who took her in during a moment of crisis. She found a home. There was a deep intimacy and care in the way she described these women, a kinship that she felt with them. Jeff's abstinence from drugs of any kind allowed him to return to his previous place selling drugs on the corner. With the return to dealing, he had to reassert himself to regain his former place and status. Though his cousin never said it directly, it was implied that Jeff had shot someone to reestablish his level of credibility. In each of these accounts, there is something in the shadow of the experience of therapy that remakes the meaning of therapeutics. But there is even more here about the way living is unexpectedly folded into the narrative of addiction and recovery. It is one thing to claim that life worlds outside the clinic are blended with the values and practices within the clinic. But perhaps it is more important to be reminded of the impossibility of taking the endpoint of addiction and the therapeutic process as the point from which to judge either success or failure of a therapy, or whether life followed a desired course, one that could be valued positively or negatively, only in retrospect. Jeff was a pharmacotherapeutic success. He was clean and intended to stay clean. Tanya was an utter failure, having deepened her drug abuse. In the end, the outcomes were the same. A note on continuity and rupture. The adolescents I followed challenged the idea of continuity in ethnographic work, or at least forced a rethinking of the concept. This is not to say that medical anthropology suffers a lack of awareness when it comes to rupture and discontinuity, but in an ethnography of drug dependence and treatment, these concerns seem enmeshed in the everyday. It is surprising that adolescents, whose lives are marked by such overwhelming institutional presence, move so quickly beyond or out from under these institutions. These abrupt turns raise a difficult question. What kind of reliance on forms of institutional life is anthropology, and for that matter, medicine, willing to endure? Here my meaning is twofold. There is a reliance on institutions resulting from the mere practicality of doing ethnographic work on medical topics. And secondly, it seems impossible to dislocate institutional life from a life in which illness and healing is experienced. Once they leave institutional environments and the relationships originally formed there, where do adolescents go? The accounts of their experiences in and out of drug dependency treatment begin to suggest that there is something worth understanding in the shadow of anthropological work. The trajectories of Jeff and Tanya each followed force the shadow of their disappearances to be as present as that which is normally seen in the light of therapeutics in the clinic. Thank you for your attention.